Imagine like taking a massive heroic dose of magic mushrooms. You know, you're prepping for this profoundly intense, visually overwhelming psychedelic
Right,
experience.
you're buckling in for a really heavy trip.
Exactly. But right beforehand, you swallow a standard, everyday, non-sedating anxiety pill.
Okay.
You'd probably expect the trip to be, I don't know, maybe just a little bit calmer.
Yeah, be slightly less edge of your seat, right?
Right. But instead, the visual hallucinations, like the very hallmark of the psychedelic experience, they almost entirely vanish.
Wow.
The walls just stop melting. The geometric patterns fade. And why? Because right now, hidden deep inside your brain, there is this microscopic biological switch.
And that switch possesses the power to literally shut down a hallucination in its tracks. It's
It
wild.
is wild. So, welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in an absolutely fascinating piece of source material. It's this comprehensive, highly technical August 2026 article from the OOTW Journal.
Titled The 5-HT1A Receptor, Serotonin's Calming Switch.
Yes, that's the one. And okay, let's unpack this because the mission of this deep dive is to deconstruct a biological mystery that is operating at this very millisecond inside your own nervous system.
Literally right now, as you're listening.
Exactly. We're going to explore how a single microscopic neuroreceptor governs your baseline anxiety and how it dictates the incredibly frustrating, agonizing timeline of modern antidepressants.
Which is a huge deal for so many people.
It really is. And finally, how it acts as a literal physical brake on psychedelic states.
I mean, it is one of the most astonishing mechanisms in human neurobiology. We spend so much time, like, talking about the receptors that drive the brain into overdrive,
The fun ones.
right? The ones that create these massive sensory explosions that we just completely ignore the neurochemical machinery designed to pull us back into the silence.
Yeah, and the overarching philosophy of this text fundamentally dismantles the way pop culture talks about the
Oh,
brain.
absolutely.
For decades, we've been fed this narrative that consciousness and mood are controlled by like simple volume dials. You're depressed, so your serotonin dial is just too low.
Right. So you take a pill, the chemical volume goes up, and you magically feel better.
But the OTW Journal piece points out that the brain doesn't have a volume dial at all.
No, it operates through a delicate, relentless tug of war between excitation and inhibition.
Every single thought, every shift in mood, it's the result of forces driving the brain's electrical activity up, right?
Right, but clashing simultaneously with forces pulling that electrical activity back down.
And if you're listening to this, you might be asking yourself, like, why should I dedicate the next hour to understanding this alphabet soup of 5-HT this and 5-HT that?
It sounds super technical at first.
It does. But the answer is simple. Because whether you're deeply interested in the frontier of mental health treatments or, you know, the hard pharmacology of psychedelics, or honestly, just how your own baseline mood is quietly regulated on a random Tuesday afternoon, understanding this specific calming switch changes absolutely everything about how you view your own mind.
It really reframes it. You aren't a machine that just needs more fuel.
Right.
You're an ecosystem in constant negotiation with itself. The brain is obsessive about balance.
It really hates extremes.
Exactly. It views any extreme state, even extreme joy or massive sensory stimulation, as a potential threat to its structural integrity.
Okay, so let's unpack this further. Because whenever we hear about serotonin in the news or whenever the media covers the psychedelic renaissance, all the attention, every single headline goes to the loud receptor.
The famous one.
Right, the 5-HT2A receptor. That's the one famous for opening the doors of perception, right? The one that makes LSD and psilocybin do what they do.
Yeah, that's the rock star receptor.
But according to this OOTW Journal article, there is an older, much quieter receptor sitting right next to it that does the exact opposite.
Yeah, so serotonin actually acts on at least 14 different receptor subtypes throughout the central nervous system. 14 distinct locks that this single chemical key can fit into. But as the text highlights, two of these receptors completely dominate the story of human mood and altered states.
The 5-HT2A, the famous one, and 5-HT1A, which is the hidden architect we're talking about today.
They are near perfect opposites.
Which is so counterintuitive because they're triggered by the exact same molecule. We're talking about serotonin or, you know, 5-hydroxytryptamine, if we're being formal about it.
Right, 5-HT.
The exact same molecule drifts across the synapse and hits both of these receptors, but the results could not be more divergent.
It's incredible.
But let's not lose the listener in the jargon here. The source says 5-HT2A is G-coupled and excitatory, while 5-HT1A is guy-coupled and inhibitory.
Right.
Before we talk about what that means for a hallucination or like a panic attack, we really need to know what those terms actually mean mechanically. Like, what is the G doing inside the cell?
Okay, let's break down the cellular machinery. Both of these receptors belong to this massive family called G protein coupled receptors, or GPCRs.
GPCRs, got it.
Imagine the cell membrane of a neuron as a thick, fatty wall. The receptor is a protein that winds its way through this wall 7 times.
7 times through the wall.
Right. The top part sticks out into the gap between neurons, waiting for serotonin to come along.
Okay.
The bottom part hangs down inside the cell, and it's attached to a molecular complex called a G protein.
So the G protein is essentially the messenger on the inside of the room, just waiting for someone to knock on the outside of the door.
Precisely. That's a great way to put it. When serotonin docks onto the outside of the 5-HT2A receptor, it actually changes the shape of the entire protein.
It physically twists.
And that twisting causes the G protein on the inside, specifically a GQ protein for 2A, to detach and go running through the cell.
Okay, so the GQ protein detaches. What does it do?
The GQ protein triggers this huge cascade of chemical reactions that ultimately results in the neuron becoming highly excitable. It ramps cortical activity up.
So it's getting ready to fire.
Exactly. It gets the electrical spark ready to jump. It is an excitatory cascade.
But the 5-HT1A receptor, the star of our deep dive today, uses a completely different messenger. It uses a G protein.
Right. And the I stands for inhibitory.
Inhibitory. Okay, so what happens when serotonin hits that one?
When serotonin docks onto the 5-HT1A receptor, the G protein breaks off inside the cell, just like the other one. But instead of hyping the cell up, it does two incredibly important things.
What's the first one?
First, it inhibits an enzyme called adenylate cyclase, which basically lowers the overall energy signaling in the cell.
So it calms it down a bit.
Yeah. But more dramatically, the second thing it does is it forces open these specific gateways on the cell membrane called potassium channels.
Okay, I want to pause here because this is where the actual physics of human consciousness takes place, which just blows my mind.
It is wild.
The article notes that opening these potassium channels hyperpolarizes the neuron, making it fundamentally less likely to fire. Mechanically, how does a potassium channel actually do that?
So neurons operate on electricity, right?
Right.
And that electricity is generated by the difference in charge between the inside and the outside of the cell.
Okay, like a battery.
Exactly like a battery.
Yeah.
At rest, the inside of a neuron is negatively charged compared to the outside. It's sitting there at roughly negative 70 millivolts.
Negative 70.
Right. In order for that neuron to fire, to send a thought, a feeling, or a visual signal, the inside needs to become positive enough to hit a specific threshold.
It has to cross a line.
It needs to reach about negative 55 millivolts to trigger the spark. And that spark is known as an action potential.
So the neuron is basically constantly hovering just below the firing threshold, just waiting for enough positive charge to flood in and set it off.
Now, think about potassium ions.
Mm.
They carry a positive charge, and they're highly concentrated inside the neuron.
Okay.
When the G protein from the 5-HT1A receptor forces those potassium channels open, all those positive potassium ions rush out of the cell.
Oh, because they're leaving the cell.
Right. As positive charge leaves, the inside of the cell becomes even more negative. It drops from negative 70 down to maybe negative 80 or negative 90 millivolts.
Wow.
That process is called hyperpolarization.
You are literally pulling the neuron further away from the firing line.
The electrical threshold required to fire remains exactly the same, but you've just dropped the starting point way down.
So it's much harder to reach negative 55 now.
Exactly. The neuron is now much, much harder to activate. It is actively being hushed.
Even if other things are trying to stimulate it.
Even then. The surrounding neurochemical environment can be absolutely screaming at this cell to fire. But because the 5-HT1A receptor has bled out all the positive charge, the cell simply sits in silence.
Man, I want to ditch the old cliche metaphor of the brain having gas pedals and brake pedals. You know, that always felt too binary for something this dynamic.
It is a bit simplistic.
It feels much more like active noise cancellation in a pair of really high-end headphones.
Oh, I like that.
Right. Like, the 5-HT2A receptor is letting in the chaotic, loud music of the environment. It's exciting the system. But the 5-HT1A receptor isn't just a physical barrier blocking the sound.
No, it's doing something active.
It is actively broadcasting an inverted electrical signal. It is hyperpolarizing the environment to perfectly phase cancel the chaotic electrical noise and force the system into a state of deep, quiet equilibrium.
What's fascinating here is the absolute sheer elegance of that biological design and also the paradox of it. We are talking about two deeply opposing forces, the noise and the noise cancellation, and they're both activated by the exact same footstep.
The same serotonin molecule.
Exactly. Yep. When serotonin is released into a synapse, it binds to whatever is available. It is triggering the excitatory GQ cascade and the inhibitory G cascade at the exact same time.
Just a complete biochemical clash.
And the resulting subjective state, whether you feel anxious, calm, or psychedelic, depends entirely on the localized ratio of these receptors in a specific brain region and, you know, how sensitive they are at that given moment.
I hear that and I understand the mechanism, but from an engineering standpoint, I just have to push back.
Okay, let's hear it.
That seems horribly, hopelessly inefficient. Why wouldn't the brain just evolve a single receptor type that operates on a sliding gradient?
A single dial?
Yeah. Why build two entirely separate competing molecular pathways that literally fight over the exact same molecule in the synaptic cleft? It feels like building a house where the thermostat turns on the furnace and the air conditioning at the exact same time.
I mean, it absolutely looks inefficient if you view the brain as a machine trying to maximize output, but it makes perfect sense if you view the brain as a biological organism desperately trying to avoid self-destruction.
Avoid self-destruction.
Yeah. Unchecked electrical excitation in the central nervous system is incredibly dangerous.
Mm.
It leads to excitotoxicity, where neurons essentially break themselves out and die from overstimulation.
Oh, wow.
It leads to seizures. It leads to severe manic states.
So it's not a design flaw. It's the ultimate failsafe.
Exactly.
Mm.
Evolutionarily speaking, a system that can excite itself without a built-in, parallel, simultaneous mechanism to rein itself in is a system destined for catastrophic failure.
That makes a lot of sense.
By having the same molecule act on both an excitatory and an inhibitory receptor, the brain ensures that every single time it initiates a highly energetic state, it naturally, unavoidably activates a countermeasure.
Like a biological tether.
Yes. It ensures that the pendulum can only swing so far into chaos before the tension of the tether pulls it back to the center.
That sets up a profound foundation for the rest of the source material. We have this 5-HQ1A receptor, this microscopic active noise cancellation system that drags neurons away from the firing threshold.
Right.
But the OTW article goes on to explain that if this receptor is simply a calming switch, how does it manage to govern so many vastly different psychological phenomena?
Which is the big question.
Yeah, because the source dictates that it alters acute panic attacks, it shapes the agonizing recovery arc of major depression, and it dictates the subjective intensity of tryptamine psychedelics.
All from the same receptor.
Right. And the answer, the article claims, lies entirely in neuroreal estate, where the switch is physically installed entirely changes what it silences.
Geography in the brain absolutely dictates function. A neuron in the prefrontal cortex does something entirely different than a neuron in the brainstem, so inhibiting them will yield completely different subjective results.
Okay, so the text breaks this down into two distinct functional locations. First, we have the raphe nuclei, and second, we have the postsynaptic targets in the rest of the brain. Let's tackle the raphe nuclei first, because this is where things get slightly complicated.
Definitely.
The article explains that in this specific region, 5-HT1A acts as an autoreceptor. Can you walk the listener through the anatomy of this?
So the raphe nuclei are a cluster of highly specialized neurons located deep down in the brainstem, right near the base of your skull.
Base of the skull. Got it.
This tiny cluster is essentially the central manufacturing hub for serotonin. These neurons produce the serotonin, and then they have these incredibly long branching arms axons that project upward and outward, webbing into almost every other part of the brain.
Just delivering serotonin everywhere.
Right, delivering it to the cortex, the amygdala, the hippocampus, you name it.
So the brainstem is basically the power plant, and the axons are the power lines running out to the rest of the city.
Exactly. But a power plant needs to know how much power the city is actually using, otherwise it might blow the grid.
Right, you need some kind of feedback.
This is where the autoreceptor comes in. On the cell bodies of these serotonin-producing neurons in the raphe nuclei, you have a massive concentration of 5-HT1A receptors.
On the factory itself?
Yes. When these neurons fire and release serotonin, some of that serotonin doesn't go down the long power lines. It drifts backward, right back onto the neuron that just released it, and binds to these 5-HT1A autoreceptors.
So it's literally monitoring its own exhaust.
It is a classic negative feedback loop. Because we know 5-HT1A is inhibitory, because we know it opens potassium channels and hyperpolarizes the cell when serotonin hits the autoreceptor, it actively silences the serotonin neuron itself.
It turns itself off.
It throttles the firing rate. The more serotonin the cell releases, the more the autoreceptor gets triggered, and the harder it forces the cell to stop releasing serotonin.
So what does this all mean for someone actually dealing with a mood disorder? I have to be honest, looking at this mechanism, it feels like an evolutionary betrayal.
Betrayal? How so?
Well, if the autoreceptor acts as a strict negative feedback loop, isn't it actively working against human happiness?
I see what you're saying.
Like if a person is suffering from clinical depression and their synaptic serotonin levels are low and the brain finally manages to produce a little bit more, why does our biology have a built-in mechanism to shut down the serotonin factory the very millisecond it gets going? It feels like biological self-sabotage.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of biological homeostasis, we have to remember that the brain is not optimizing for your subjective happiness.
It's not.
Not at all. The brain does not care if you feel joyful or fulfilled or content. The brain is optimizing for survival and stability. It thrives on equilibrium.
Survival over happiness?
Always. The autoreceptor is a biological thermostat. Think about the heater in your house.
Yeah.
If you set it to 68 degrees and it suddenly jumps to 75, the thermostat kicks in and shuts the furnace off.
Right, right.
Even if you, the conscious inhabitant, happen to be shivering and want it to be 80 degrees.
So the thermostat doesn't care about my subjective experience. It only cares about deviations from the programmed baseline.
Exactly. The brain uses this autoreceptor to prevent profound chemical deviations. A massive sudden spike in serotonin is not inherently a good thing.
No.
In fact, as serotonin levels run completely unchecked, you develop a condition called serotonin syndrome.
Oh, I've heard of that.
It's very serious. It involves massive autonomic instability, high fever, rigid muscles, seizures, and it can be entirely fatal.
So it's a literal lifesaver.
Right. The brain doesn't know you just want to feel a little brighter. It just registers that a vital neurochemical is rapidly deviating from its historical baseline, and its primary ancient directive is to return to that baseline at all costs.
It is incredibly stubborn. It will forcefully drag you back to your baseline, even if your current baseline is a state of miserable, heavy depression.
Now, contrast that stubborn factory manager with the second location mentioned in the article, the postsynaptic receptors.
The ones out in the city.
Yes. These are the 5-HT1A receptors located everywhere else at the ends of those long power lines. They're in the hippocampus, the prefrontal cortex, the hypothalamus, the septum, and, critically, the amygdala.
And the amygdala, for the listener, is our brain's primal threat detection center. It's the fire alarm.
Exactly. When 5-HT1A receptors are located postsynaptically, meaning they are sitting on the receiving neurons in the amygdala, not on the serotonin-producing neurons in the brainstem, their job is totally different.
What are they doing there?
They aren't controlling the serotonin factory. Their only job is to quiet the specific neuron they are attached to. I want you to paint a picture of a person experiencing an acute panic attack or a moment of severe, crushing anxiety.
Okay, so their amygdala is absolutely lit up. It is an electrical storm of fear processing. The neurons there are firing wildly, rapidly reaching that action potential threshold over and over again, screaming at the sympathetic nervous system to initiate a fight or flight response.
Spot on. In the midst of that neurological storm, the serotonin power lines from the brainstem drop serotonin into the amygdala.
Okay.
That serotonin finds the postsynaptic 5-HT1A receptors on those panicking cells. Mm. The GI protein cascade initiates. The potassium channels fly open. Positive charge bleeds out of the panicking cells.
They hyperpolarize.
They're rapidly hyperpolarized. They're dragged away from the firing threshold.
The active noise cancellation kicks in. The fire blanket is thrown over the electrical storm and the panic subsides.
You have a single protein structure, the 5-HT1A receptor, doing two wildly divergent but equally vital jobs based purely on where it was built.
It's just a matter of location.
Yes. In the brainstem, it acts as a tyrannical factory manager, keeping the serotonin system from overworking itself. But downstream in the amygdala, it acts as an incredibly potent neuropacifier, keeping the rest of the brain from overreacting to the stress of the outside world.
The sheer complexity of that dual role perfectly explains one of the most agonizing, universally frustrating mysteries in modern medicine. The article spends a significant amount of time diving into this, and it illustrates exactly how the 5-HT1A autoreceptor is entirely responsible for the pain of millions of patients.
Yes.
We are talking about the SSRI lag.
This is a pharmacological paradox that has baffled patients and practitioners for decades.
Let's lay out the reality of this. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, are the most commonly prescribed antidepressants in the world. Drugs like fluoxetine, sertraline, citalopram.
Very common.
If you or anyone in your family has ever been prescribed one, you know the grueling protocol. You sit in the psychiatrist's office, deeply depressed, and they hand you a prescription. But they always offer the exact same caveat.
They say, take this pill every single day, but do not expect to feel any better tomorrow.
Right. In fact, you might feel worse. It is going to take anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks for this medication to actually lift your depression.
Which, from a patient's perspective, is an absolute eternity. When you are in the depths of a major depressive episode asking you to hold on for another 40 days while experiencing the side effects of a new medication, that is a massive, highly dangerous hurdle.
But chemically, the OOTW article cites a pivotal paper by Blyer and Ward from 2003, and the data in that paper is infuriating when you think about it.
It really is.
Blyer and Ward demonstrated, using microdialysis techniques measuring neurotransmitter levels in real time, that SSRIs do their job immediately. They block the reuptake pumps in the synapse within hours of taking that first pill.
Within hours.
The serotonin levels in the synaptic cleft spike almost on day one. So if the chemical imbalance is being corrected on a Tuesday, why doesn't the depression lift until the middle of next month?
Because the brain is not a passive sponge absorbing chemicals.
Yeah.
It's an active defensive ecosystem fighting back against the intervention.
The source points a finger directly at those presynaptic 5-HT1A autoreceptors in the raphe nuclei. The stubborn thermostat.
Exactly.
Let's walk through the exact timeline of a patient taking an SSRI day by day according to this mechanism.
All right. On day one, the patient swallows the SSRI. The medication travels to the brain and blocks the serotonin transporter, which normally vacuums serotonin out of the synapse.
Okay.
As a result, serotonin begins to rapidly accumulate in the extracellular space, particularly around the raphe nuclei.
The synaptic flooding begins.
But remember the thermostat. Those 5-HT1A autoreceptors sitting on the serotonin neurons suddenly detect an enormous, unprecedented surge in serotonin.
They realize it's flooding.
They are flooded, and because their only job is to maintain baseline equilibrium, they essentially panic. They trigger massive GI protein cascades. They hyperpolarize the serotonin-producing neurons to an extreme degree.
They hit the brakes hard.
They clamp down with everything they have, and they drastically, severely slow the firing rate of the serotonin neurons.
So the drug is trying to pool serotonin in the synapse, but the autoreceptors react by shutting down the actual production of new serotonin. They are actively canceling out the drug's effect right out of the gate.
Exactly. For the first week or two, you have a complete stalemate.
A stalemate.
The SSRI is preventing the cleanup of serotonin, but the 5-HT1A autoreceptor is preventing the release of new serotonin. The net gain for the patient's mood is essentially zero.
And because the system is under stress, they often just experience side effects like nausea or increased anxiety.
Right. But the patient keeps taking the pill. Day 3, day 10, day 20,
yeah.
The SSRI keeps forcing serotonin to pool around those autoreceptors.
Relentlessly.
And this is where neuroplasticity comes into play.
Oh.
Biological systems cannot maintain a state of perpetual alarm indefinitely.
They have to adapt.
After weeks of continuous, relentless bombardment by high levels of serotonin,
yeah.
The 5-HT1A autoreceptors finally begin to undergo a structural change. They literally begin to downregulate and desensitize.
Yeah, what does that mean structurally?
The cell starts pulling receptors back inside the membrane. The G protein cascades become blunted. The thermostat fundamentally breaks under the pressure.
It just gives up. It stops fighting back.
Once those autoreceptors desensitize, the brake is released. The serotonin-producing neurons in the raphe nuclei resume their normal firing rate.
Okay, so the factory turns back on.
But now, because the SSRI is still blocking the vacuum pumps everywhere else in the brain, the serotonin levels in the downstream targets like the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus finally genuinely rise in a sustained way.
And that's when they feel better.
It is only in that moment, 3 to 6 weeks later, the patient wakes up one morning and feels the depression begin to lift.
Here's where it gets really interesting and a little bit tragic.
Yeah.
The SSRI was never slow. The drug was working at maximum capacity on day one. Our brain's ancient defense mechanism, this microscopic 5-HT1A switch, is just incredibly frustratingly stubborn.
Very true.
The therapeutic delay, the month of suffering, is literally just a waiting game. It's the time it physically takes to forcibly break down the brain's 5-HT1A brake pads.
Which raises an incredibly important question for psychopharmacology.
Oh.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, if we know exactly what is causing the delay, why do we tolerate it?
Right. I mean, if we know the autoreceptor break is the sole reason millions of people suffer for an extra month, waiting for the dawn to break, has anyone in the medical field ever tried to just, I don't know, chemically cut the brake line?
It is the most logical next step, and the OPW article details how science actively pursued this exact strategy. Throughout the late 90s and early 2000s, researchers ran clinical trials adding a specific drug called pindolol to standard SSRI treatments.
Pindolol. The article defines pindolol as a 5-HT1A receptor antagonist, a blocker.
Mechanically, an antagonist is a molecule that perfectly fits into the receptor's binding pocket, but it lacks the correct shape to actually twist the protein and activate the gyroprotein protein cascade.
So it sits in the lock like a broken key.
Exactly. And while pindolol is stuck in the 5-HT1A receptor, the actual serotonin molecules bounce off.
So the logic is brilliant in its simplicity. You give a severely depressed patient an SSRI to flood their system with serotonin. But at the exact same time, you give them pindolol.
Right.
The pindolol races to the brainstem and plugs up all the 5-HT1A autoreceptors. So when the SSRI causes that massive initial serotonin surge, the autoreceptors have blindfolded. They can't detect the surge, so they never hit the panic button. They never shut down the serotonin factory.
The hypothesis was that by hacking the thermostat, we could entirely bypass the month-long waiting period. Mm-hmm. We could achieve profound antidepressant effects in a matter of days.
And did it work?
The clinical results were incredibly revealing, though somewhat mixed. Many of the early trials showed a statistically significant acceleration of antidepressant response.
Oh, wow.
Patients taking pindolol alongside an SSRI often saw their depressive scores drop much faster in the first 2 weeks compared to those on a placebo.
That sounds like a massive breakthrough.
It was. But later meta-analyses showed that the effect wasn't always robust enough or consistent enough across diverse populations to become the absolute gold standard of care. There were also complexities, because pindolol isn't perfectly selective.
What else does it hit?
It also interacts with beta-adrenergic receptors, which affects blood pressure and heart rate. So there were side effects to manage.
Even if it didn't become the universal cure for the SSRI lag, it absolutely proved the underlying biological principle, didn't it?
Oh, without a doubt. It proved that this single microscopic receptor is quietly governing the entire tempo of human psychiatric recovery. We are beholden to its desensitization timeline.
It highlights the ultimate challenge of modern neuropharmacology. We are rarely ever fixing a broken mechanism. We are almost always trying to manually override a deeply entrenched, highly functional biological defense system.
Well said.
And the 5-HT1A receptor isn't just a hurdle for depression. It is also a primary direct target for a whole distinct class of anxiety medications. The source points out that 5-HT1A is the primary mechanism of action for azapirone drugs, the most famous being buspirone, widely known by the brand name Buspar.
Right, Buspar.
As well as newer derivatives like tandaspirone and gipirone. These drugs are categorized as partial agonists of the 5-HT1A receptor.
Let's define partial agonist because it's a beautifully subtle pharmacological tool.
Okay, lay it on me.
If serotonin is a full agonist, meaning it hits the receptor and causes a 100% activation of the G protein cascade, a partial agonist like buspirone hits the receptor and only causes maybe a 40% or 50% activation.
So instead of blocking the receptor with a broken key like pindolol, they are actively stimulating it, but gently. They are resting their foot lightly on the brake pedal rather than slamming it to the floor.
Exactly. When a patient with generalized anxiety disorder takes buspirone, the drug circulates to those downstream postsynaptic 5-HT1A receptors, particularly in the hyperactive amygdala we discussed earlier.
Right.
It binds to the receptors, initiates a mild geoprotein cascade, opens the potassium channels just enough, and provides a continuous, gentle, hyperpolarizing tone to those fear circuits. It nudges the system toward calm.
What I find so crucial here, and what the article emphasizes, is how vastly different this targeted approach is compared to the traditional heavy-handed way we treat acute panic and anxiety.
Oh, night and day.
I want to contrast buspirone with the mechanics of a benzodiazepine drugs like Xanax, Valium, or Klonopin. Their article notes that benzos don't touch the serotonin system at all. They operate by enhancing the GABA system.
GABA, or gamma-aminobutyric acid, is the brain's primary universal inhibitory neurotransmitter. If 5-HT1A is a specific localized brake on certain circuits, GABA is the main power breaker for the entire central nervous system.
And when you take a benzodiazepine, you are artificially supercharging that GABA system. You are forcing chloride channels open everywhere in the brain, flooding neurons with negative ions and causing profound global inhibition.
Which is why benzos are incredibly effective at stopping a panic attack in 20 minutes, right?
They work fast.
But they come with a massive cost, They cause profound sedation. They impair motor coordination. They interfere with memory formation.
Yeah, people black out on them all the time.
And because they are bludgeoning the brain's global reward and inhibition pathways, they carry a notoriously high risk of tolerance, physical dependence, and brutal withdrawal syndromes. You are essentially wrapping the entire brain in thick, heavy lead blankets.
But buspirone, by specifically targeting the 5-HT1A receptor, works with surgical precision. It isn't a sledgehammer, it's a scalpel.
I love that analogy.
It utilizes a natural, highly specific physiological pathway to dial back fear processing in the amygdala without turning off the lights in the rest of the house.
Exactly.
You can take buspirone, experience relief from generalized anxiety, and still safely drive a car, stay awake through a meeting, and maintain your cognitive sharpness because you aren't suppressing the global power grid. You are just activating the brain's bespoke active noise cancellation in the regions that are too loud.
It is a profound shift in how we approach psychiatric care. We are moving away from blunt force trauma and moving toward negotiating with the brain's native regulatory systems.
Okay, so we've established the immense quiet power of the 5-HT1A receptor. It is powerful enough to fiercely fight off pharmaceutical antidepressants for a month, and it is powerful enough to gently cure clinical anxiety without putting you to sleep.
Right.
So what happens when this powerful, stubborn brake pedal goes head-to-head with the most intensely excitatory substances known to human science? What happens when 5-HT1A encounters a massive dose of a classic psychedelic drug?
This is where the neurology transitions from clinical medicine into the truly cinematic frontier science of human consciousness.
The OATW article shifts focus to the pharmacology of hallucinogens. According to the source, the 5-HT2A receptor, our GQ-coupled excitatory gas pedal from the beginning of the deep dive, is the undisputed driver of the psychedelic trip.
Unquestionably.
If you introduce a massive dose of LSD, psilocybin, or mescaline to a human brain, the 2A receptors go into overdrive. They trigger chaotic firing cascades in the visual cortex and disrupt the rigid filtering systems of the thalamus. But the article makes a definitive point.
Which is?
If you block that specific receptor using a drug called ketanserin, the psychedelic experience completely vanishes.
Ketanserin is a highly selective 5-HT2A antagonist. It plugs up the 2A lock perfectly. Studies have shown that you can give a patient a massive ego-shattering dose of psilocybin, but if they have been pre-treated with ketanserin, nothing happens.
Nothing at all.
They might feel a little physically strange, maybe a bit restless, but there are no fractals, no melting walls, no profound spiritual insights. 5-HT2A is the absolute bouncer at the door of perception. If it is blocked, you do not trip.
However, the article introduces a critical, deeply complicating factor. Classic psychedelics, specifically the class of molecules known as tryptamines, which include psilocybin, DMT, and LSD, are not clean keys.
No, they're not.
They do not only fit into the 5-HT2A lock. Because their molecular structure is an indolamine, incredibly similar to natural serotonin, they inherently bind to our old friend, the 5-HT1A receptor, as well.
They are promiscuous molecules. Because both the 2A and 1A receptors evolved to receive serotonin, any chemical mimicking serotonin well enough to fool the excitatory receptor is almost certainly going to fool the inhibitory receptor to some degree.
And because 5-HT1A is inhibitory, its activation by the psychedelic molecule acts as a built-in intrinsic brake on the very hallucinogenic state that the 5-HT2A receptor is frantically trying to create. It is a literal biological tug of war happening simultaneously inside billions of your synapses.
The drug molecule is pressing the accelerator to the floor, but the very same molecule is resting its foot on the brake. The ultimate visual and cognitive intensity of the trip is simply the mathematical sum of that conflict.
The evidence cited in the article for this push and pull is absolutely wild. The text highlights a seminal study by Pokorny et al., published in 2016, which I want to spend some real time on because it proves this concept so beautifully. Pokorny and his team did an incredibly elegant, deeply revealing experiment on human consciousness.
They essentially decided to manually manipulate the tug of war in real time.
Exactly. They took a cohort of healthy human subjects. In the control group, they gave them a standard, robust dose of psilocybin, the active, psychoactive compound in magic mushrooms. As expected, these subjects reported a full-blown psychedelic experience.
Standard trip.
Right. On standard clinical scales measuring altered states of consciousness, they reported intense visual hallucinations, complex closed-eye geometries, and profound alterations in the meaning of their surroundings. The 5-HT2A accelerator was roaring.
But then they brought in the experimental variable.
In the experimental group, Before administering the psilocybin, they pre-treated the subjects with buspirone. Remember, buspirone is the 5-HT1A partial agonist. It is the anxiety medication that actively presses the biological brake pedal.
Right, the gentle brake.
They let the buspirone circulate, ensuring the 5-HT1A receptors were actively engaged, hyperpolarizing the cells, initiating those G-protein cascades. Then they gave them the exact same robust dose of psilocybin.
The results of this specific pharmacological combination are astonishing.
What happened? The subjects reported that the visual hallucinations were markedly, drastically attenuated. They were dampened. The sheer visual intensity of the trip, the fractals, the melting environments, the vivid colors was essentially turned down from a 10 to a 2.
Just from the anxiety pill?
Yes. The subjects still felt the physiological body load of the drug. They still felt some emotional shifts, but the core visionary aspect of the trip was suppressed because the researchers had artificially placed a heavy foot on the 5-HT1A brake.
It is a staggering demonstration of neurochemical power. You are literally chemically modulating the visual intensity of a hallucination, taking a hyper-complex, subjective human experience and dialing it down simply by engaging a single inhibitory G-protein cascade.
It's wild to think about.
You are proving that a hallucination requires rampant, unchecked electrical excitation, and if you bleed that excitation away through potassium channels, the vision cannot sustain itself.
But the OOTW article doesn't stop there. It cites another study that approaches this tug of war from the exact opposite, arguably much more terrifying, direction. It references a 2026 paper by Zahid, Strassman, and colleagues. They ran the mirror image experiment.
If Bokorny pressed the brake harder, Zahid and Strassman decided to see what happens when you remove the brake entirely.
They took human subjects and gave them our other old friend, pindolol, the 5-HT1A antagonist, the broken key that plugs up the receptor and blocks any inhibitory signaling. They chemically cut the brake lines in the subject's brains. Then they administered NN-DMT. For context, smoked or intravenously injected DMT is widely considered one of the most overwhelmingly intense, rapid-onset psychedelics on Earth. It famously launches users into entirely different perceived dimensions, often encountering entities or complex alien architectures.
DMT is already a substance that pushes the human nervous system to its absolute functional limits in terms of sensory overload.
So what happens when you give someone DMT, but you have preemptively removed their brain's ability to pull the emergency brake? The Zahid and Strassman study found that the subjective effects of the DMT were significantly heavily intensified.
By removing the natural 5-HT1A inhibitory tone, the 5-HT2A accelerator was allowed to redline completely unchecked.
Just floored.
Every bit of the DMT molecule that would normally have been wasted pressing the brake was now free to contribute to the rampant excitatory cascade. The patients experienced an even deeper, more profound, and more jarring dislocation from consensus reality because the biological tether we talked about earlier was severed.
So just to clarify this and make it incredibly real for the listener, does this mean that every single time someone takes a classic psychedelic out in the world, at a retreat or in their living room, they are simultaneously taking the biological antidote to that very same psychedelic?
That is a brilliant and highly accurate way to frame it, yes. The chemical is fighting itself. The ultimate intensity of a psychedelic trip is not just a straightforward calculation of how many milligrams of the substance you ingested or the purity of the batch. It is heavily, intimately dictated by your personal, real-time 5-HT1A tone.
Meaning how hard your specific brain is naturally inclined to press that brake pedal at any given moment.
Exactly. We spent endless hours in the psychedelic community talking about set and setting, your psychological expectations, the music in the room, the comfort of the environment. But we rarely talk about the underlying biological state of the hardware.
The actual brain state.
Right. If your natural 5-HT1A tone is remarkably high that day, perhaps due to fluctuations in your endocrine system, or a baseline state of high chronic stress, or even genetic variations in your receptor density, your brain is actively fighting the trip harder.
Your biological brake pads are gripping tight.
Exactly. You might take 3 grams of mushrooms and feel surprisingly grounded.
Huh, if your 1A tone is low on a different day, that exact same 3-gram dose from the exact same batch is going to hit you with drastically more visionary explosive force because the accelerator is meeting almost zero neurochemical resistance.
It perfectly explains the notorious unpredictability of these compounds. You always hear anecdotal reports of two friends taking the exact same dose, and one has a mild, giggly afternoon looking at the clouds, while the other is launched into a harrowing, ego-dissolving journey through their childhood trauma.
It's all about the breaks.
You aren't just a passive, empty vessel receiving a drug. Your complex, constantly shifting neurochemistry is actively negotiating with the molecule in real time.
It is a dialogue. And the 5-HT1A receptor is the relentless skeptic in the room, constantly pulling the electrical charge down, constantly asking the cortex, are we absolutely sure we want to go this fast?
And that dialogue brings us to the final and perhaps most profound section of the OOTW journal article.
We know that standard psychedelic psilocybin, LSD, classic DMT are a tug of war between the 2A accelerator and the 1A brake. The psychedelic wants to accelerate and the brain resists. But this raises a fascinating, mind-bending question.
Let's hear it.
What happens if a psychedelic molecule is structurally evolved to overwhelmingly prefer the brake? What if a molecule doesn't just tap the 5-HT1A receptor as a secondary side effect, but absolutely prioritizes it and slams on it with massive chemical force?
You are describing a pharmacological profile that fundamentally rewrites the rules of the psychedelic state. You're describing the god molecule.
Yes. 5-MeO-DMT. For those listening who might not be deep into the pharmacology of hallucinogens, 5-MeO-DMT is a compound found naturally in a few plant species and, most famously, secreted by the Sonoran Desert toad.
The toad venom.
Right. It is widely described by both researchers and users as the most potent, most philosophically jarring psychedelic known to science. But according to the source material, its pharmacology is profoundly, fundamentally different from its famous cousin, classic N,N-DMT.
Classic DMT leads with the 5-HT2A accelerator. It is highly visionary. 5-MeO-DMT, on the other hand, has an unusually, extraordinarily high binding affinity for the 5-HT1A receptor.
It is heavily mathematically biased toward the biological brake.
Exactly. It still hits the 2A receptor, but its preference for the 1A inhibitory system is massive.
And the scientific evidence for this unique mechanism is definitive. The article cites a crucial study by Winter et al., published in the year 2000. This was an animal behavior study, and the methodology is brilliant.
It's a classic assay.
Researchers took animals, usually rats, in these types of studies and trained them to recognize the specific internal subjective effects of 5-MeO-DMT. Through operant conditioning, the animal learns to press a specific lever only when it feels the unique internal state caused by 5-MeO-DMT. It becomes a biological assay for the drug's presence.
The animal is essentially saying, yes, I recognize this specific altered state.
Right. So once the animals are perfectly trained to recognize the 5-MeO-DMT state, the researchers introduce the twist. They pre-treat the animals with potent 5-HT1A blockers. They use drugs like pendolol or a highly specific research chemical called WEI100635, which aggressively plugs up the 1A brake. Then they give the animal the 5-MeO-DMT. What happens?
The animal stops pressing the lever.
They stop pressing it. By blocking the inhibitory brake pedal, the researchers substantially and entirely abolish the signature discriminative stimulus effects of the 5-MeO-DMT. The animal no longer recognizes the drug.
That completely flips the script on everything we just learned about classic psychedelics. Think about the Zahid and Strassman study. With classic DMT, if you block the 1A brake, you intensify the trip because you let the accelerator run wild.
Exactly.
But with 5-MeO-DMT, if you block the 1A brake, you destroy the drug's signature effect. The drug relies almost entirely on the brake to do what it does. Its defining characteristic is massive, widespread neurological inhibition.
Yes. And this deeply 5-HT1A forward pharmacology changes the nature of the human experience entirely. The clinical descriptions of 5-MeO-DMT are vastly different from ayahuasca or mushrooms. The article describes it beautifully.
It's a completely different vibe.
Because the molecule is leaning so unbelievably hard on the inhibitory GI protein cascades, because it is actively forcing potassium channels open across the cortex, it causes significantly less kaleidoscopic imagery.
Right, it's not visual.
There are rarely complex fractal geometries, no encountering of humanoid entities, no swirling colors. Instead, it produces what the text calls a formless oceanic dissolution into unity.
Oceanic dissolution.
Mm-hmm.
That is a heavy, almost theological concept appearing in a hard pharmacology paper.
I really want to try and visualize this difference for the listener because it's the crux of the entire deep dive. Think about a standard 5-HT2A-led psychedelic experience, like a high dose of LSD. It is additive.
Additive, yeah.
It is like a chaotic, wildly creative, hyperactive painter has broken into the room of your mind. They are frantically decorating the walls of your consciousness with incredibly complex geometry, neon colors, and bizarre narratives. The structure of the room, your core sense of self, the walls of your ego are still largely there. They're just currently covered in wild, screaming paint. You are watching a light show.
Right. The architectural structure of the self remains intact, but the sensory input being fed into that self is dialed up to 1,000. You are an observer overwhelmed by data.
But a 5-HT1A-led experience, like the one triggered by 5-MAMU-DMT, does not paint the walls, because it is fundamentally inhibitory, because it is actively hyperpolarizing and quieting down the electrical activity in the cortex. It doesn't add any new sensory data.
What does it do?
Instead, it gently, but with absolute unstoppable force, dissolves the walls themselves. It quiets the electrical hum of the room down so completely, so thoroughly, that the boundaries of the room vanish until there is no self left to even look at the walls.
This raises an important question, perhaps the most important question in all of cognitive neuroscience and philosophy. What actually is the ego? What is this sense of I, this autobiographical self that we carry around with us every single day?
The default mode network.
Exactly. Neuroscience increasingly points to the default mode network, or DMN, a network of interacting brain regions that is highly active when we are awake, but not focused on the outside world.
Right.
It is the network responsible for daydreaming, for worrying about the past, for planning the future, and fundamentally for maintaining the rigid narrative of who you are. It maintains the boundary between me and the rest of the universe.
But maintaining that boundary requires energy. It requires constant rhythmic electrical firing.
Building on that, if stimulating this specific inhibitory 5-HT1A receptor with a molecule like 5-MeO-DMT has the physical power to quiet the machinery of the default mode network so entirely that a person experiences formless unity, it suggests something profound about human identity.
What does it suggest to you clinically?
It suggests that our sense of individuality, our precious ego, isn't some magical, ethereal soul stuff anchored in our chest. It might literally just be a constantly humming electrical pattern, an active, energy-intensive metabolic process in the cortex.
A vibration.
We have to constantly expend biological energy to maintain the illusion of our own separateness from the environment. And when 5-MeO-DMT floods the brain and forcefully presses the 5-HT1A brake on those specific networks, it simply turns off the power supply to that electrical hum.
It just cuts the power.
The ego doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't travel to another dimension. It just stops vibrating.
Wow. Yeah. It just stops vibrating. The 5-HT1A receptor, this tiny protein string sitting on a cell membrane, literally possesses the physical switch to turn off your sense of being a separate individual. It is the biological off switch for the human ego.
And returning to the OBTW article's core thesis, it shows that the true character of a deeply profound, life-altering state of consciousness isn't always about excitation.
No.
Sometimes the most overwhelming, structurally profound experience a human being can endure isn't a massive explosion of sensory data. It is the absolute, unyielding silence of total neurological inhibition.
It is just staggering to think about. We've covered a massive amount of ground today on this deep dive. Let's try to synthesize this journey.
Let's do it.
We started with the comfortable pop culture idea that brain chemistry is simple, like a stereo volume dial. But the OATW journal article has thoroughly dismantled that illusion.
We have replaced the volume dial with a highly complex dynamic system of checks and balances.
We've learned that the 5-HT1A receptor is truly the unsung hero, the hidden architect of the human mind. It is the absolutely necessary other half of the serotonin story. While the 5-HT2A receptor gets all the media glory for being the accelerator that drives neuroplasticity and hallucination, 5-HT1A is quietly sitting there as the active noise cancellation.
Yep.
Consciousness, as we've seen, isn't written by any single receptor acting alone. It is written by the constant, agonizing, beautiful balance between excitation and inhibition.
Whether it's acting as a stubborn biological thermostat on the serotonin factory in the Rathi nuclei, or deploying a hyperpolarizing fire blanket over the fear storm in the amygdala, its evolutionary mandate is to keep us grounded.
And its effects dictate so much of the human experience. It is the primary target for modern anti-anxiety medications that soothe the amygdala without sedating the global cortex.
Right.
It is the stubborn, unyielding roadblock that completely explains why antidepressants take an agonizing month to start working. And it is the hidden hand resting on the dial of the psychedelic experience, whether it is turning down the vivid hallucinations of magic mushrooms or driving the complete oceanic dissolution of the self in a 5-MeO-DMT breakthrough. To truly understand the drive of the human mind, You must intimately understand the break.
It reminds us that our brains are not rudimentary machines designed for simple linear output. They are incredibly sophisticated ecosystems designed for survival, balance, and nuanced regulation in an unpredictable world.
Which leaves me with one final lingering thought. Something for you, the listener, to mull over long after this deep dive ends.
Oh, I like these.
The pharmacology is clear. Our brains come pre-installed with this incredibly powerful, localized calming switch. We possess a receptor capable of literally dampening hallucinations, fighting off pharmaceutical interventions, and dissolving the human ego into a state of formless unity. So, if we don't have access to synthetic molecules or rare desert toads, what natural, everyday states might secretly be pressing this exact same button?
That is a beautiful and vital question.
Could deep, sustained, decades-long meditation practices naturally alter our baseline 5-HT1A tone? When you fall into a perfect, timeless flow state while working, coding, or creating art, and your sense of self vanishes, or when you experience a moment of profound, breathless awe looking at a massive night sky and you feel instantly small and connected to everything, is that spiritual experience simply your own internal chemistry quietly resting its hand on the 5-HT1A break?
It makes you realize that the profound states of unity we desperately seek out through intense chemicals or years of rigid discipline might just be waiting for the right moment for our neurons to naturally hyperpolarize, open their potassium channels, and simply quiet down.
Next time you think your brain is just a simple volume dial waiting to be turned up, remember the break. Remember the quiet power of a single microscopic switch gently whispering to the nervous system to let go.